Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Matthew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spring from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foolish.
Yeah.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, plenty to talk about in sport. Thank you to all those who've made contact and said they love the show and have been listening to it religiously. It's really nice to get feedback like that and makes it all worthwhile. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
Well, John, good to see you again. And I must first up congratulate you. Fairest and best, I believe, in the is it over 50s?
Over 50s, Divi 3.
Well, that's still an achievement.
Gold. Divi 3 gold. There's no Divi 4 and over 50s. There's two Divi 3s.
Well, well done. A good achievement, a good season. And yeah, I mean, good. But you still haven't washed your shirt, I hear.
No. I'm going for premiership number 4 in that shirt. It's got 3 unwashed premierships in it already. I'm going for number 4.
Oh, dear. Just keep it away from me. Now, obviously, we've got a lot to talk about on the show as usual. And our guest on this show is a gentleman from the Netherlands called Herman Cruyff. Now, Herman was the coach of the Dutch women's hockey team, also has coached at Push in Breda, and he came up with the idea of a water-based pitch, but having the water underneath the pitch and having it come through the bottom of the turf, as opposed to having the hoses on the pitch. So a really environmental-friendly solution. Some people aren't too sure about it, but we'll have a chat with him to find out, you know, how he came up with the idea, how it works, and, well, you'll see the video clip as well on how it all works on the website as well. But I think it's a good idea, and especially in these environmental times where we don't want to be wasting water, this is a really good solution.
Well, even just from the side of things, I saw it happen in Matt's grand final, my reverse stick co-host, and also we saw it happen at the Champions Trophy for the men, the turf's drying out, and the drag flickers having the push-outs for the short corner having to get a bucket of water and tip it onto the pitch before they took the push in because it was, yeah. So there's room for it in the game for that sort of innovation, that's for sure.
But I think there's also room for it in other sports as well, as we'll hear later in the show. Now, am I going to start us off this time?
You can.
Look, I've gone for something slightly different, and I don't know if you saw the comments of the CEO of Fox Sports, and he was coming out, that's Mr. Patrick Delaney, came out in the recent weeks saying that obviously they're going to have to revisit the way Fox Sports do things. And he was saying, he was comparing it to the airline game where you have Qantas, which is your premier legacy airline, and then you have Jetstar, which is obviously the discount airline. And what he was saying is that the broadcasting of sport is going to have to go down that path. So they're still going to have the Fox pay TV subscriber model, which will be the Qantas model, if you want a pet to example of how it's going to work. But he was saying then for those people that want to get sport on their phones or on their tablets or other ways through their laptops, then there'll be an app application that they can get through that. And it may be pay per game or pay per event and whatever, because he's saying at the moment, the way it is, there's just no way that they can monetize the investment that they're putting into these sporting events or competitions such as the AFL or the A-League or whatever to make money from it. So they're going to either have to cut that right back, and of course the sports would really struggle if that was the case. Now I still question whether they're going to be able to make the sums of money that they managed to make when you look at the deals that were done. I mean, if you take the deal with the AFL that was mentioned, I know it's the sport we don't mention on this show, but this time we're going to have to. I mean, it was a 6-year, $2.5 billion deal. Now, when that was put together, Telstra paid $300 million. That was for the handset and digital device rights. Channel 7 paid $840 million in cash and $60 million in contra, and News Corp paid $1.3 billion. So it was spread over several outlets. Now, if you're going to do that now, they're not going to be able to do that. So they're going to, as Patrick Delaney said, it's going to be like a sort of Netflix option, that it'll be a pay-per-view. And digital space, there's no doubt, is taking over from terrestrial TV or whatever, and people are not watching. I know when we've live-streamed hockey tournaments and other things, when you look at the data you get from YouTube and it shows you how people are watching the games that you're live streaming, very few are watching it through their TVs. It is predominantly through a computer or through a mobile device. And so I still think you're going to see the money, although they're talking, you know, that there's still, they're going to have to monetize the digital spaces where the money will be made, and it will be, but I don't think we're going to see the levels of money that have been talked about. I think you're going to see TV stations, if they're still involved. Let's not forget, there are some outlets out there now that are purely in the digital space, and you just saw the J-League were bought in Japan for that, and they paid a phenomenal amount. Now, they obviously feel that they can get that money back, but it's going to be a very interesting few years, I think, and I would think a few sports would be very, very nervous as to whether they're going to get the same money that they got from their TV deals in their next negotiations.
Well, I can't see it happening. I mean, they're not going to get close, really, because by the time those next set of negotiations roll around, we're going to be another 2 or 3 years further down this digital track. So there's going to be more people then that are going to be accessing it via digital platforms. I mean, I must admit, I love the live streaming on, and the digital, the way, what, the possibilities of it. Oh, I can't watch a sports event on a mobile phone. I don't care how big you reckon that screen is. You cannot tell what's going on.
I'm with you 100%, but then we are of an older generation.
We are. And look, they don't, the broadcasters don't care as long as you're watching it somewhere. If you want to watch it on a mobile phone, they're happy for you too. If you want to watch it on a computer, they don't care.
I think the interesting thing for me, John, is you're going to see, and now there is the capability that you can now stream through so many different platforms. Mm. That's always been a problem previously, but now the data, the technology is there to be able to do it. And with our live streaming, we've just actually upgraded to be able to offer that to people that we're live streaming, that we can actually stream it now through YouTube, through Facebook, through Twitter, through all of those various platforms, so that they can get this broad view. What I think is going to be interesting is how many players are going to come into the market, which again, that is going to dilute the marketplace as well, because some of those players may offer a better service. Like, you may take some of the niche sports, for example, where people have the expertise and the knowledge in that particular sport, and they're a respected individual, and you think, well, if they've set something up, they know that the fans are going to go there. Because I still believe that good commentary can make bad coverage more viewable.
Yeah.
Whereas bad commentary makes even the best coverage just unbearable to watch. I mean, I'm not going to say what I watched the other day. The commentary was diabolical, and I actually gave up, in fact, on the game after 15 minutes. I just went, I can't bear this. Even with the volume turned down, it just, then it lost all meaning.
And that said, I mean, the FIH has done a great job in getting a lot of some of these more satellite type tournaments and lower grade tournaments onto digital platforms for us to watch through YouTube, etc. But there's no commentary, and I can't watch that because I don't know who the players are. I don't know any and so you turn that off as well. Commentary is intrinsic to broadcasting. If you got the pictures, you need the words as well, otherwise you don't know what's going on.
But I also think that you're doing a disservice to the athletes if you don't have commentary. Because let's look, every athlete wants to be known. They want to get credit for what they do, for credit for their performances, if they have ambitions. And let's take, for example, one of the tournaments you're saying, where we had the Asian Champions Trophy, which was streamed, I think it was the women's one was in Korea earlier in the year.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, there might be some of the players that were playing in that. Certainly, as you've seen, Japanese players have been playing in the Hufklasse recently. And so there would be players there that would have ambitions to play in those top European leagues. Now, there may be European coaches watching going, well, who's that? I don't know who that is. And again, it doesn't help them. And we've seen that in local level. I've seen it in the NPL football here, where coaches from the A-League have come across and they've got a program on a match day. And I happen to be standing next to one of the coaches just a year or so ago. And he's going, I said, who are you here to watch? He goes, oh, the number seven. It wasn't the number seven, but I'm just picking that number. And he goes, he goes, he's not that good. I was told he was really good. I said, well, what player are you meaning? And he told me the name of the player, you know, and I said, well, he's not wearing number seven. He's actually wearing number 13 or whatever. But in the program, he was number seven. So the coach had come across with a view to signing a player who'd been recommended because, again, the program was wrong. He nearly left that ground going, well, the player I was told to look at is rubbish. So the scout he had, he suddenly doubts his reputation, but also the player very nearly missed out on an opportunity to go on and play in the A-League. Now, he didn't go on and play in the A-League, but the opportunity could have been squandered because, again, there's just that lack of care about what's being used to promote the game, to promote the team, to promote the player.
Oh, look, I couldn't agree with you more on the subject of match day. What do you call them again? It's gone from my head.
Match day experience, I suppose.
Oh, no, the little booklet you get.
Program.
Sorry, it's been not very well at the moment. My brain's not quite working as it normally would. But, yeah, we both mentioned that before, that programs, I find, is essential. If I go along to an event, I want to be able to identify people. And you can't expect that everybody turns up is going to have an encyclopedic knowledge of every player that's playing. I mean, that's a joke. But we seem to be, you know, oh, you're a hockey person, you should know. Well, mate, there's thousands of hockey players.
But it's not that difficult. I mean, if you look, the FFA did the same thing when the Matildas played Thailand here. They did not bother to bring out a match day program. Now, this was an international match. Now, again, there are people that collect international programs. You know, football program collecting is a massive, massive thing, as it is in several sports. So suddenly you didn't make, there's no record of that game now in terms of a program for historical purposes. And there was a great piece I read recently where this person went through programs from yesteryear and was saying how much you can learn historically about those times from the comments of the chairman, from the comments of the coach. You suddenly get a time capsule of what that era was like and the attitudes and what was going on at the club through the match day program. And now, if you take that away, you have nothing. And I just thought it was, again, the FFA trying to cut costs but cutting it in the wrong areas.
Well, you've seen the old Porn Stars, PAWN, that program where, you know, about the pawn shop and rah, rah, rah. And they quite often get people bringing programs in that might be signed by a famous player or whatever like that. There's actually a market. People will pay money for these things down the track, and they do become historical items.
Yeah, I must admit, I regret, and I don't think they were worth anything, but I regret getting rid of all the programs. I had all the programs from every game of Swindon Town I'd watched before I moved to Australia. Had a massive box of them, and I just picked the key ones out. So, for example, when Swindon played against George Best's Fulham, when Bobby Moore was there, Rodney Marsh was there in the FA Cup, and it went to two legs, I kept those two because I'd actually seen George Best play, and I wanted to keep that program. But I regret getting rid of so many of those programs because, again, there's players since I've met who live over here now, you know, and I've missed out the opportunity of actually sort of going through a program that they were involved in.
Now, this isn't sporting, but this is one, because we're in my shed and I just grabbed it off the shelf there. From 1984, Spike Milligan, his tour. It's the program, and you open it up, and I'm immediately transported back to that evening, one of the funniest nights of my life. It was an incredible night. But that's why they should be producing these things, so nuffies like me can hold on to these things for years and years and years.
And if you look at it now, John, live streaming is the digital program, I think, in a lot of ways, because it is something that a player... If you look, there will be players that have played in this year. We live streamed the state hockey competition for Hockey WA. Now, there will be players that played in that, will go on and play for Australia, will be immensely successful playing for either the Hockey Roos or the Kookaburras. But that is something that people will be able to go back to refer to them and go, wow, do you remember when he played in the grand final in 2018 or whatever, or he played in the semi-final and that goal he scored? And, you know, and to me, this is now the program, the digital program of yesteryear, you know, the print program of yesteryear is now the live streaming of today.
And it's up to sports to embrace it as well and to go with it. I mean, we've seen a situation where, with the Australian Hockey League that's just started, we've been hearing for months now about this wonderful new Australian Hockey League we're going to get and how we're going to see all of the games streamed live. Well, lo and behold, a week before the bloody tournament starts, what do we get? Oh no, we're going to stream the finals live, but we'll just have some highlights packages of the round games. What? Highlights packages? So you've got the cameras at the ground, and you're recording the entire game, but you're not going to stream it live. What you are going to do is waste a whole pile of money sending that video, to some bloke to edit down into a highlights package. Then you're going to get someone to do a voiceover. Why wouldn't you just stream the game?
I must admit, editing it is going to cost you a lot more than just streaming it live.
It will. The other side of it is, you can't come out and tell people you're going to do that and then not do it and change your mind.
But that's where the stakeholders have to make them accountable. If that's the case, then the stakeholders have to stand up and say, hang on a sec, And I mean, they need to be pressuring their state bodies and going, well, you're our representative when you go to the Hockey Australia table, and you need to be asking.
That, Ashley. We're still playing hockey, aren't we? Aren't we still playing hockey?
But, well, what was the song Sting on Klingons on the Star of a Bay? It's hockey, but not as we know it.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacobi from Germany, playing for the Delhi Wave Riders. You're hearing Not the Footy Show.
Well, that's probably enough of the talk about that, but I think it's going to be very interesting to watch that space in the next couple of years. But as we said at the top of the podcast, we've got a very, very interesting guest on the show now, and we're crossing over to the Netherlands, where we're going to catch up with a man who has an invention that could really revolutionise sport being played on artificial pitches. And so it's with great pleasure I say, Herman Kruijs, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Good morning, all. My name is Herman Kruijs, and I'm at the moment national head coach of the field hockey ladies team Belarus. Also, I'm head education European Hockey Federation, developing coaches all over Europe, and I'm head educator of the World Hockey Organization. So I give a lot of courses in the world. Final courses and a lot of training with the national team and also my own club Push in Breda. That's not my job. My job is principal of the Johan Cruyff College in Roosendaal.
But you've had a long involvement with hockey, haven't you?
Yes. I was around 12 years I start to play, and I played from an 18 till my 29 in the first team in Breda, Push Breda. And at that moment, our managers say, Herman, you are too slow for a synthetic pitch. It's better that you will be the coach of the first team. And so from captain of the first team, I changed to head coach of the first team. And that was independent of the water pitch. It was too quick for me. So they changed it.
And I mean, the reason we're talking now is because of that involvement, that obviously the water-based pitches have become a big part of the game. But it is a problem in the world where water is in high demand, or we're running out of water. So you've been trying to find a way to still have the water-based pitch but not waste so much water.
Yeah. That's totally right. I was with the horseman, Jeroen Dubbeldam. He is Olympic champion. And he invited me in his stable, and he had a pitch to drive with the horses. And it was a very hot day. And I was looking to the pitch where he was driving with the horses. And I say, Jeroen, strange, the pitch is wet, but it is very dry. What is happening? Oh, and he explained me that under the pitch, there was a basic system, a water basic system, that the water was bringing up to the top level of the pitch. And so it was always the same water level on that pitch. If it was beautiful weather or it was bad weather, it doesn't matter. It was also the same basic in that pitch. So the pitch was always the same level water. And so I thought, hey, that's also possible with a water-based pitch. So I was going to a company and I explained my idea, and we start with a small box. And we build in the small box the system. In a, you know, where you have fishes in your room, a box like that.
Yeah.
And we started, and then you see that the pitch, then we had a basic, yeah, ground, lava from special, and then the water is coming up. We built one tank with water, and then we fill the water tank. And the water tank bring the water under the pitch. And the pitch is waterproofed. So there's no water out of the environment. It stays in the under the pitch. And you can, with a pump, you bring it around. So the water, and you know the communicate basis, when I give water here, it fills this tank also in the same level. So it's always the same level. When I give the level in the box, in the first box, on the right stand, then I have the stand on the pitch exactly the same. this really communicate on this way.
Yeah, so, no, I understand.
And when it is very dry, of course there is water going out in the air. But then this tank fill with the second tank, then he fill on the right level, and it's water stay on the same level. So two tanks and the pitch. Now when you turn it, in the Netherlands we have the problem, when it is around 0 degrees, the water-based pitches will be frozen. But this water is rotation. And so it is not standing still. And when it is not standing still, it's more difficult to freeze. So now you can play when it is under 4 degrees, because the water is rotating.
And I would think if it's rotating as well, that means you're avoiding it stagnating as well, because that was one of the issues I could see would be a problem, because still water can turn stagnant.
No, I think it's not. The big problem is to make the pitch waterproofed. And the problem in Breda, we have one pitch in Breda. On this way, the company didn't build the pitch well. It was not totally closed, so the water is going out, and that's the big problem. But in Zelena, Croatia, there is a pitch, and there is it very well. It's working there. They play World Hockey League on that pitch. It was around 30 degrees, and never sprinkling the pitch because it was always the same level.
So how often do you have to refill those tanks? I mean, or do they stay fairly consistent?
We can use it with the rainfall of the Netherlands. So, very clear what you can do. Roof, when you use the roof of the clubhouse and it rains and you bring it in the second tank is full, then you only use rainwater.
Wow.
And the, we think it is, you use around 8 to 9,000 cube water in a year for a water-based pitch, and this is around 700. That's exactly what the rain is in the Netherlands. So when you have a good idea, you can use the roof or you can use other things when it rains. You bring it in the tank in one time, then you have a reserve, and when it is a dry period, he fills the other tank by himself, and so all time you have the same.
So somewhere like Australia, you could presumably sort of store the rainwater over the winter months when we have a great high rainfall, and then that may well get you through most of the summer months?
Yeah, that's an idea, yes. And you must think about how big the tank must be to cross over the winter period or the summer period. When it is dry, you must think about it, how many water will out during the hot period and how many water you need, but then you can make the tank so big you like and you can use it.
Could it be used for other sports, not just hockey? I mean, for example,
yeah, of course it is very easy, because important is that the carpet, the water can through the carpet, that's important. Because the water is coming under the carpet a little bit, and then you feel it's wet. And that's right. That's the right level. And you can play with the level, because when your opponent is very good, you like maybe a slow pitch, then you set the water a little bit higher. That's possible. Because when you set in the tank, the water tank, the first water tank, a little bit higher, then also under the carpet it will be a little bit higher. Will you have a very fast pitch, then you bring it a little bit lower and you have a fast pitch. So it doesn't matter which synthetic you use, but it must be transparent. The water must be in the carpet.
No,
and when you see in the hockey in Australia, on Sydney Park, I was there, and you see the water-based pitches, they're sprinkling the pitch and the pitch is wet. And that's the right wet you have also when you use this system.
I'm sure the environmentalists must like your invention a great deal, because it saves a lot of wastage waters.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And in expensive, it is the same expensive as a normal water-based pitch.
So it's the same price. It's not more expensive.
Yeah, it's the same price. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I mean, what's the demand been like around the world now? People are becoming more aware of what you've come up with. Is there a lot of interest?
At first, yes, but the problem is that the company who was working with me stopped with water-based pitches. And so there is nobody who do the marketing for this product. And when I make this ID, I'm a school director and not a builder from pitches. So when you have a good company, we can start. And then a good marketing plan, and it is okay.
No, I mean, have you spoken to the other pitch manufacturers, or have you?
No, because I have no time to do that. No. I'm traveling for World Hockey and European Hockey and Belarus, and so I'm too busy to organize this. But be my friend and say I will arrange it. It's no problem.
All right. Well, I'll certainly see if we can get the message out there, because obviously there's a few manufacturers over here in Australia that I'm sure would be interested.
I have some clips. While you are interested, I can send you the clips.
Okay, no, I'd be very interested, and I can share those. I'm just going to ask you finally, Herman. I mean, is this your first sort of real idea, or have you always been somebody that's sort of thought a little bit out of the box?
No. So I have other ideas also, but not especially for hockey. But also in education, I have sometimes idea out of the box, yes. Yeah.
And is it hard getting people to listen to those ideas?
You know, people are always thinking about confidence. And when it is out of the box, they have no confidence. So when you bring new ideas in education, then also people are very nervous. And they say, no, the old way, old-fashioned way is okay. But I hate it. And also, I was, for example, we had players with problems on the legs, with the skin. And I saw in the horse world that the legs of the horses were cooled by a machine. And I said, hey, stop. We can use it also for people when they have problems on the legs. And now we use it. And it is from the horse sport, and I bring it in the hockey sport.
That's amazing.
Yeah, this is very nice to do that. Yeah. Well, so are ideas. When you are at the synergy between different sports is very important, and then you can learn a lot of.
No, absolutely. Well, it's been great catching up with you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, I will send you the clip. And when you have questions about that, you can ask me.
Thank you very much, and all the very best.
Yeah, you too. Have a nice day.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, John, obviously some really interesting stuff there coming from Herman, and a really great environmental piece of technology if people want to embrace it. And just a reminder, if you want to see the video clip, if you've linked to this podcast via Facebook, go to the website notthefootyshow.com, because the video clip will be supporting it in the post where the podcast is being hosted. So you can actually see how the whole thing works there.
Oh, certainly a great idea too for the warmer climates like ours, or Spain and places like that, I assume, because it is an issue. The drying pitch is an issue. And
what I like, though, is the fact that you can use the rainwater. So you're not actually doing that. So as he mentioned there, you're collecting the rainwater, which is a natural resource. It's then going into a sort of like tank that you're keeping it. So you're not having to necessarily use other water. You're just recycling what's coming out of the skies, and it's working.
Yeah, look, I think that model works in Europe. I think you'd have it back.
Yeah, it would be a little bit of a problem here.
But, I mean, you're going to save water. For a start, it's obviously going to save more. If the water's coming up from underneath and sitting just on that subsurface level and keeping everything, you're not going to get the same problems with evaporation you do when you just spray shit all over the place.
Spray what, sorry?
Water.
Now, the other thing, just quickly before we wrap up on, obviously, Herman's interview, and if anyone is interested and they want to get in touch with him, feel free to contact me here at Not the Footy Show. You can email me or via the Facebook page or even via the website, and I can put you in touch with him. But I think Fremantle, your hockey club, have been looking to have a turf pitch, haven't they, put in? And I just like the beginning bit of the interview there where he said he was told he was too slow to be playing in the first team. I was thinking this could be ideal for you, John, a pitch where, depending on how much water you let sleep through, you can determine the pace of the pitch. Could be perfect for you.
It could be. I was... At our wind-up, I was talking to a couple of lads, and our game had been streamed live. Our grand final was streamed live on YouTube through a mobile phone. It wasn't fantastic, but it was a bit of a laugh for us, and we all thought it was pretty good. And I'd always thought, you know, okay, we're over 50s, but, you know, we're getting around. We play good hockey. I'm zooming around the field. I'm doing all this fantastic stuff, and I'm feeling like a real great athlete. And then I watched the vision and just went, oh, God, you're an old man. It was a real eye-opener. It was really, yeah. I don't think I need the pitch to be slow.
Anyway, it's your topic now.
What is the future for combat sport?
Wow.
In the wake of what we've seen from...
And I'm presuming what you're saying, when it goes to combat sport, are you talking specifically UFC or MMA, or are you talking all combat sports?
All combat sport.
So even your martial arts like a judo and which is at the Olympics, and there's been absolutely no issues in those type of sports.
I think what will happen is that those sports will be able to greater protect themselves from any backlash that will come in the future, because there is starting to be a backlash against it. I mean, but it's going to start at that mixed martial arts level, and that's where it's going to. I mean, boxing's been under pressure for decades, really. Since the heyday of boxing, what, in the 80s was probably that.
You saw recently HBO, I think it was in the USA, after 30 years of broadcasting boxing, have just gone, nah, that's it now, we're walking away from it.
And you know, boxing for a long time has had a reputation of being as dodgy as. And we're seeing dodgy results, and we're seeing dodgy fights. Like, was it Mayweather and Conor McGregor? What the hell's that about? It's just a blatant greedy cash grab, and people are going to start, you know, obviously there's a lot of fans for it at the moment, but a lot of people like me look at it and just go, are you kidding me? What a waste of time and space. Now we've seen the events of the recent McGregor, and I can't pronounce the poor fella's name.
Khabib,
that'll do. We've seen what happened post that. Now, that's actually a long running feud, and it's a long running feud that the UFC have propagated.
Oh, they've been poking it and stirring it and promoting it.
Absolutely. And now Dana White comes out and says, oh, well, it's part of the story. Is that right, Dana? So after Conor McGregor and his mates violently attacked a bus carrying people just going about their business, you think that's okay because it's part of the story? I would have thought that people behave like that deserve a jail sentence. If I walked down the street and started throwing chairs at people on a bus, I'd be locked up quick smart, and I would not be getting out in a very short space of time.
But this, John, again, it goes back to, and I think we need to, it's not just UFC, it's across all sports. Now, we know that there are sporting clubs that hush up the misbehaviour of their star players and whatever, and they will pay people off not to go to the police or not to prosecute, etc. And clubs and governing bodies need to take a far stronger stance, and they need to no longer accept that sort of behaviour, which they will see is marketing the game. It's not marketing the game, because when it backfires, it really brings the game into disrepute. And I mean, they are so quick to punish players for bringing games into disrepute, but what about the administrators for not snapping down on it? Now, I mean, I would like to see, and this is a subject for another day, but for example, the Australian Sports Commission, who hands out funding, if you were looking at it from an Australian perspective, if that happens, you go, well, sorry, you're not getting any funding, because you did not manage the people under your control appropriately, and you let this escalate to a level where it brought bad publicity to the sport.
You know, I don't think you can blame administrators or You know,
oh, you can to a certain extent, yeah, John.
You can't blame them for people's behaviour, but you can blame them for not addressing people's
behaviour. Yes, yes. No, you can't blame them for the behaviour, but you need to have the appropriate punishments or the appropriate processes in place to address those behaviours and make sure they don't happen again.
Oh, truly. And so often we see that this is just hushed up and pushed under the carpet. Or people, because they just happen to be a talented sports person, are given leniency, or even the general public. I hear people say, oh yeah, but you know, he does this for charity. I don't care. If he wasn't a high profile sportsman, they'd be in jail, or they'd be fined lots and lots of money. Even if that person who wasn't a sports star was doing great charity work as well. There's plenty of people that just make mistakes, and we've got to accept sometimes people just make a mistake and stuff up. When you make a mistake, you've got to pay the price for it, and you've got to be accountable for it. And these people are allowed to go through their sporting life unaccountable. So what happens when they get to the end of their sporting life? Did you see the figures on the number of American sport footballers and baseballers, etc., and basketballers who are broke?
Yeah, there's a brilliant documentary about that.
Yeah, like within 2 or 3 years of their careers finishing, they're broke. They've been on multi-million dollar contracts and they've got no money left.
No, it's terrifying, and I think you're going to see the same. I mean, there was an article came out from, I think, the English FA about 18 months, 2 years ago, saying how many of the Premier League footballers were in debt. Now, as you were saying there, they're earning hundreds of thousands of pounds, not dollars,
a week,
and yet they're so far in debt.
And certainly sports gambling's got a lot to do with that. I mean, a lot of these guys have horrendous gambling problems. Because they've got a bucket of money and they're 23 years old, they think nothing of dropping 10 or 15 grand on a bet.
But this is the interesting thing, because the point you're alluding to, and I can't remember the name of the documentary, it's on one of those 30 ESPN ones, and it brilliant documentary. And the guys were saying that the problem is, when the season was over, they had nothing to do and they had all this money. And so they would buy a flash boat to just muck about on the water for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And they would just blow this money because the season finished. And they were saying as well, you don't get paid in the off season in America. It's like you just get paid for the season. And so the money's there and that's meant to tide you over. But then they were saying they couldn't wait to get back to pre-season because they had no money left to be able. And it's you sort of think, wow, where's the responsibility of trying to educate these people as to that they could have an injury and their career could be over. So don't go away spending all the money. I mean, I remember when I was ill several years ago, it's 20 years ago now, and the insurance company, luckily,
well done,
I had,
by the way.
Pardon?
Well done.
Cheers. And, you know, I had income protection. I remember when they paid that, they go, listen, and it was actually brilliant, this insurance. It was, what are they called now? ING.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember they said to me, as a free plug for them, but they were really good to me, because they said, look, we're paying you this money. It is your income. Don't go crazy on it, because you're going to have to pay tax on it still. But it was really good advice, because then what I did was, even though I wasn't working and I was using that money to pay the bills, I was putting some aside because I knew that I would have to pay tax on it.
Yeah.
So again, there are people that are responsible and doing those things. So if some can do it, why can't all?
Well, look, this isn't not a sports person, but Keith Richards, okay, probably the world's most famous heroin addict. Okay, he talks about how these addictions took hold and what happened. And the Rolling Stones, when they started, were doing a lot of touring, and they suddenly had a little bit of fame, and then they're going to America, and they're coming back, and they're Europe, back to America, and for the first 5 or 6 years of that band being something, they just toured constantly, did nothing but tour, you know, playing 2 shows a day in America in 2 different cities and stuff like that. Just, I don't think we realise how hard a grind it would have been back in those days. You know, they weren't hopping on a jet and getting first class.
No, it was on a bus.
Yeah, stuff like that, which is, so it was a hard slog for them. And he says, you know, were we taking drugs? Yeah, we're taking all sorts of uppers and to keep us going. I mean, essentially, the drugs were just there to make sure we kept working. Occasionally, there'd be a bit of a jazz cigarette come out, but it was nothing serious. The problem started when they stopped touring and stopped recording. There were some issues going on with management, etc. They stopped, and suddenly, he had a whole pile of free time and a whole pile of money, and he was famous. And he said, that's where the problem started. because I'm 25 or 24. What do young men do when they've got a pocket of money? Have fun, baby. I mean,
well, I mean, I can bank a similar story. A player who played Super Rugby in this country, grew up in a certain state, got a Super Rugby contract when he was quite young, and he would go to training. All his mates were at uni. They would come around his flat in the afternoon and go, oh, you know, let's have a few beers. And of course, because he was earning more money than them, he would end up buying the beers for them. They would then all drink through to the early hours. But because he was fit, of course, he would run that off the next morning. But suddenly he realized that his game was not where it should have been for the talent that he had, and that these guys were dragging him down. So he actually, on the advice of his father, moved into state because he goes, he needed to get away from those guys because they didn't realize they were just kind of happy that he was succeeding. They were also happy he was buying all the beers because as uni students, they didn't have a lot of money, and they thought it was harmless fun, but it was actually detrimental to his career and nearly derailed it completely. And luckily when he moved into state, he was able to then succeed and go on and have a successful career, not just in Australia but overseas. But again, it's that same thing. It's that downtime. What was he doing in that downtime? Nobody, once he walked out of the club, it was like, okay, the club goes, well, it's your time now. And I just think some of those young people need guidance, but it's the downtime that's the problem, as you say.
And these people don't work back in the not that too distant past here in Australia. Most top-class athletes, be they footballers or whatever, were working and playing sport. So they didn't have that big gap in their lives that they needed to fill. And the other side of it is that they could turn up at training on Tuesday and Thursday and go out and play a ripper game on a Saturday afternoon because that was the level of competition. You can't do that anymore. You've got to dedicate yourself to more time and be more strict. You've got to watch what you eat. You've got to blah, blah, blah. The whole list goes on. So suddenly they're living in this really, really controlled environment, really controlled, and, oh, I'm free, I'm loose. And it's like the old Catholic schoolboy thing, you know. Catholic schoolboys, the legend goes that at school it was so strict and disciplined, and I remember listening to tour coach drivers telling me that the worst are those Catholic schoolboys because they get out and they run amok. They're suddenly outside of that little cocoon and their heads just explode and they go crazy.
Oh, look, I can relate a little bit to that, having been at private school from the age of seven, boarding school.
Boarding school, which would be exactly the same sort of thing. You're in that controlled environment for so long, you get this little taste of freedom, and you just grab it and try and reef as much of it as you can.
But also, I think inside that environment, you're also kicking and seeing how far you can go. You know, like I remember, you know, we were meant to black or brown shoes, and I turned up at school with a pair of blue shoes, you know, and it caused a big, big issue. And then, of course, dyeing my hair was another thing, and you know, so you have to push those boundaries.
Did you get that little David Bowie tuft at the front?
No, I didn't do that. I went the whole hog.
I'm totally blonde.
I did that. I also went chestnut when I was a bit younger, when the whole punk thing was going on.
Oh, God. I'd love to see that. You ever go to the Mohawk?
No, I did. I think that was just a little bit. The funniest thing was when I went home. So when I bleached it, there were three of us that actually bleached it with peroxide, and we were hauled in front of the headmaster and were told that we would be sent home until it grew out. And we were like, fantastic. Sounds good to me. I didn't really like my academics, so that was ideal. And then the head boy, I remember, just leant in and said, headmaster, that could be about 2 months. Oh, okay. So you will go home and you will have your hair dyed back to normal. So I remember my dad was pretty mad. He had to come and pick me up, drive me home, and he goes, actually, it doesn't look that bad. But then he goes, but you're paying for it yourself. And it was actually quite a lot of money, you know, compared to my pocket money, to have this hair dyed back to the normal colour. But the great thing was, because we actually had a bit of sun in the UK that summer, and it just bleached the dye out, and it went the fair colour and kind of pretty much stayed that colour after that. So, yeah, I was kind of quite happy with it in the end.
Back to the point, is there a future for MMA, or is it going to punch itself in the head?
I think that we'll have to wait and see, won't we? I mean, I'm not a big...
Personally, I don't like it because it's brutal, and it glamorises brutality.
I'm with you on that. I've never been a big fan, and we have had guests from MMA on this show.
And look, what happens is they punch a bloke, he goes down, and what do? They jump on him and keep punching him in the head. And we are now starting to see that in society. And honestly, I look at it and I'm sickened. It makes me feel sick watching a person getting punched in the head repeatedly. I can handle boxing, but this MMA stuff where it's just brutality and it, you know, that's how you kill people in pub fights, is sitting on them, punching them repeatedly in the head.
No, I agree. There's an art to boxing, and there's an art to judo, and there's a sort of, and there's also immense respect between the opponents as well.
I'm not having a go at the people that are in the sport. Don't get me wrong. Look, I love a bit of Bruce Lee. I love the martial arts and all that sort of stuff. But that form of combat sport, I find just really annoying and disgraceful.
Well, let's look back in a few years and see where it's at then.
Okay. Thanks, mate.
Always good to catch you.
Some people are on the fence, they think it's all over. It gets
see ya, we'll be back next week.